It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host, Jill Dittmeyer, our journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today, and we are doing it via Zoom. But we're still here with you talking about all things Da Vinci today, as the world celebrates his legacy in several global exhibitions and conferences. And Mark, you're actually one of our guests today, as is another very familiar voice for our Da Vinci Pursuit conversation. So please introduce him.
We are really pleased to welcome Dr. Jason Organ, who's the assistant professor of anatomy at Indiana University Medical School. And we've had Jason on the program before, and it's always wonderful to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here once again.
Good to have you with us, Jason.
And we're going to be talking about, interestingly enough, both of us have had some trips. We think about trips now during this time, but we did in our past, recent past, had some great trips. I was able to see a huge exhibition, one of its kind, really, in Paris early in this year, where they had brought together pretty much an incredible, almost 265 works of Da Vinci in one location. And Jason, I know you've had some pretty incredible experiences in London, I think.
Well, I was in London, and I know that some of Da Vinci's work was on display then. This was in August of 2019, but I also took a trip to Amboise, France, which is where Da Vinci's final resting place is, and his final home as well. And I was part of a colloquium on his contributions to the field of anatomy 500 years after his death, which was pretty amazing.
So let's start here for the both of you. And Mark, I'm going to start with you since the name of the organization is the Da Vinci Pursuit. And I'm going to ask Jason the same question. What is it about Leonardo da Vinci that intrigued you so much that you created a nonprofit organization named after his endeavors?
I think for me, it was he was such an individual who embodied the idea that there wasn't any separation between really humanities and science. He was never, even in his writings, if you follow what he's written and look at that in his drawings, you never got a sense that he knew whether he was in one or the other. He was fluidly moving between observing the world, writing about the world, drawing the world, dissecting. He was so curious. And it may have been the last time, I'm suspicious that it may have been the last time that individuals could have held all that knowledge in one brain. Because after that, I think knowledge exploded as science exploded. But that's why. It's because he was that embodiment of what I wished that people would be today. And so we named it The Pursuit because we wanted people to pursue being more fluid between art and science and humanities.
And Jason, how did your love of Da Vinci begin?
Honestly, it began with a phone call asking me if I'd be interested in speaking at this colloquium. And truth be told, I didn't really know much about Da Vinci other than the fact that as an undergraduate student, I studied biological anthropology, but I also had a strong interest in the humanities, always have. And so I was familiar with his work, both on the art side and also on the science side, or the engineering side more than the science side. And we actually talked about that sort of difference in perspective, I think the last time we talked about Da Vinci on here, which is the idea that a scientist is gonna hypothesis test and an engineer may not be taking that same approach. They may be approaching the structure of the human body, for example, in Da Vinci's case, by looking at the structure, right? The actual structure, and not thinking about where you might ask questions and find answers, but instead, how do all the parts relate? And it's just a different way of thinking within the sciences. So when I got interested in Da Vinci, it was because I got this phone call asking if I would be interested in looking through his work in the field of anatomy and sort of reflecting on what has changed since his time. And remarkably, not a lot has changed. He got a lot of anatomy right, and he was one of the first to do it. Unfortunately, he didn't publish it. So I think I feel a kindred spirit with him there too, because sometimes I'm a little slow to publish the things that I find really interesting because I want to keep tinkering and drilling down further.
Well, educate our listeners a little bit more then. What time period are we talking about when Da Vinci was doing all that research and learning about anatomy? And what did you find that you're still teaching your students today?
Sure. That's a great question. So the time period was, you know, the late 1400s, early 1500s. He passed away in 1519. And most of his work was done sort of in the latter half of his life. And he was one of the first people to really get access to human tissue and fully systematically dissect humans, as opposed to previous anatomists who had learned a lot of the structure of the human body by inferring that it was similar to what they could find in animals. And the truth is, you know, within mammals writ large, there's a lot of similarity. But there are certain things that make humans unique. One of those things that Da Vinci got absolutely correct is the curvature of the spine. So when we talk about curvatures of the spine being bad, and when we talk about that, we're really thinking about things like scoliosis. And we're talking about a side-to-side curvature and not a front-to-back curvature. So side-to-side curvature, very bad. That can lead to all sorts of breathing problems, walking problems, and so on and so forth. But front-to-back curvatures are requisite in order for us to keep our head balanced above our torso and our torso balanced above our hips while we walk around on two legs, which is weird for animals. It's certainly weird for primates, of which we are, because most primates are quadrupedal and walking around on all four of their limbs. And so in order to get upright, you have to change the way that your spine is curved. If you're not walking on two limbs, you're not going to develop that curvature. And Da Vinci was the first one to get that correct.
Wow, that, you know, that talks about that whole balance, right? Because you're right, that curve has to be just right, as all of us know, or otherwise we'd be out of balance.
Absolutely. In fact, it's one of the diagnostic characteristics. If you look in the fossil record and you try to investigate what were the origins of what we call bipedal locomotion, or walking around on two legs. And one of those hallmarks is the wedging shapes of the bodies of the vertebra. So if you stack vertebra together, you know, if they were just perfect little cylinders, like short cylinders, there would be no curvature in the spine. It'd be like stacking coffee mugs on top of one another, right? Be completely straight. But in the back and in the front of vertebrae, depending on which part of the spine you're in, there is wedging that happens. So either the front part of the vertebral body is a little bit higher than the back part of it, and so there's a wedging toward the back, or vice versa. And the shapes of those bodies create planes where vertebrae sit on top of one another and then can form that curve. And that develops as you learn to walk. What's amazing is that you know, we're born with a curvature that's very C-shaped in our spine, just like quadrupedal mammals, sort of a C-shaped, where the convexity is toward the back, so posteriorly facing. And as we learn to hold our head up, when we're about 6 months of age, we start to develop a curvature in the top part of our spine, the cervical part, the neck part of our spine. And that's reversed of the convexity in the posterior side of the back. It's convex in the front. And so we can hold our head up. And it's not until we start to walk around on two limbs at about 12, 14 months, whatever it is, do we start to develop a curvature in our lumbar, our lower back region of our spine, in the same direction as the curvature in our neck region. And so we get this sinusoidal curve. It looks like an S, where we have curvatures that are going both convex posteriorly, or to the back, and convex to the front anteriorly. And that is a hallmark of the fossil record. So if you find vertebrae that are wedged in particular ways, you know that that animal was walking around in a bipedal mode, not necessarily on four limbs, because otherwise they would not have developed that curvature. It's pretty cool.
When you look at his, like when I was in France, and you look at some of his journals, because they had tons of those there, the pages, that it's amazing what he was dissecting. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, he did humans like we were talking about, but he was taking apart lots of things and very curious about what it was inside. In fact, there's tales apparently around the time above him, you know, the place where he worked was really smelly, which I can only imagine there was no preserving anything. But he was amazing. I mean, you have these drawings of this person intently looking inside something.
It's true. So, you know, a lot of the reason that he started his dissection wasn't necessarily to learn, or we don't know that it was to learn about the human body. It was really to inform his art, right? How do you make a more realistic looking sculpture? How do you make a more realistic looking drawing? And so if you know what's underneath the skin, it can help you design the way that the skin should look in some sort of piece of art. And so you're right. Absolutely. Marquis was dissecting all sorts of things, horses, bears. In fact, what is really interesting was that bare feet are one of his, you know, big pieces of drawing. He likes to draw bare feet. And within humans, back to some of the things that he noticed, there are these little bones in the ball of your foot. They're called sesamoid bones. They're bones that develop within the tendon of a muscle. You have several of them in your body, a couple in each of your feet. You have your kneecaps. Those are sesamoid bones too. Those are the largest ones in the body. And he actually identified some other ones that turned out to be not correct. They were just incompletely fused bones. But he did identify the ones in the human foot. He was the first one to identify those. And I think we've discussed this in the past, how much I love that structure in the foot, just because it creates this tunnel. So you've got this short muscle, short flexor of the big toe. It's called flexor hallucis brevis. And it attaches to the two sesamoid bones in the ball of the foot. And you've got a tendon of a long flexor of the big toe that runs right in between the two tendons of the short flexor that are attached to those sesamoid bones. And those sesamoid bones actually keep the ball of the foot off the ground so that the tendon of the long flexor can go in between them through this little tunnel and still be effective, even though you've got all your weight on the ball of your foot. It's really fascinating. Well, he identified them in humans. He didn't notice them in bears, and bears have them at every single one of their digits. So, you know, some things he found and some things he didn't find. It's amazing sort of, you know, where the mistakes were made.
Yeah, and his art and his engineering, it was interesting because he was identifying, I noticed, he was also not just his art, but he was also very much into, at the time, creating these things for these pageants. So they would have these big parades and pageants, and there were mechanical things. In fact, what some people have thought were, you know, his first designs on a helicopter or whatever probably weren't. They were mechanical devices that were never intended to fly, but to be in these big elaborate performances. So he was looking at bird dissection and other things just for how does locomotion work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that's actually what appeals to me the most, because my training is in comparative biomechanics. I'm interested in how bones and muscles move an animal and how that changes either through time or changes with differences in loading behavior, so different kinds of locomotion and so on and so forth. And so I've always had this sort of mechanical engineering perspective to my work, even though I'm not a mechanical engineer by any stretch, but I borrow heavily from engineering theory. And it's very clear that that's how Da Vinci approached the human body too. And that's what's so appealing to me. So when I was asked to be part of this colloquium, it was a no-brainer that I was going to say yes. And it's not just because it was going to be held, you know, in Amboise, France, but instead because I was literally given the excuse to pore over all of this Da Vinci work and spend a lot of time looking through anatomy that I hadn't thought about or ways to think about anatomy that I hadn't thought about ever.
And when you gave your presentation, what was that all about? What did you share with the people there?
Well, some of what I shared was the curvature of the spine, because I found that to be fascinating. I also shared my perspective on the sesamoid bones in the ball of the foot. But there were several other places where he got things correct that I thought were fascinating. For example, He was the first person to think about how muscles are arranged around a bone. So if you take a cross section through the thigh, for example, you'll see the quadriceps on the front side of the femur, the thigh bone, and you'll see the hamstrings on the posterior, the backside of the femur. And he actually paid very close attention to where different muscle bellies sat relative to one another in that cross section. And he was the first one to really approach anatomy in a cross-sectional manner. Now, that is the way that most people study anatomy now. Not necessarily in school, but anytime you go in and get a CT scan or an MRI because you have some sort of injury, or perhaps they're scanning for disease, they're looking at the body in cross-section. They're looking at the same kinds of images, although computer-generated, that Da Vinci was creating by sawing through different layers and making these cross-sections and identifying where different muscles were and weren't.
And both of you, obviously you saw his work, and I think what is most interesting is that he was going about it as an artist first and a scientist second, maybe not even as a scientist, but he suddenly, the science kind of just showed up as he was trying to do these drawings and recreate these types of muscle structures to make them more realistic.
Yeah, we noticed from when you see all of his works collected, one of the things you notice first off is that he went back at things. So he would go back into what he had sketched often and make corrections with newer evidence. Well, that's pretty much early science. In other words, he didn't stay just with pure art as a way of getting that. He was trying to correct it to be what he found. And so you'll see in many of his sketchbooks, by the way, I wanted to tell you all that the most amazing thing to me were the sizes of sketchbooks. So they were from as large as maybe 13 by 19.
Oh, wow.
All the way down to something that was about 1.5 inch to 2 inches big. And the sketches and writing that he did in there was meticulous. It showed, it was perfectly detailed. And so it's hard sometimes because when you'll see pictures of things to get a sense of scale. But when in this exhibition, so he was writing, he used every bit of paper. And the only way I understand all that was that paper was so expensive, it's so difficult to come by, that he was one of those, he used every corner of it, making notes or even notes to what he wanted to get at when he went out to the, you know, to buy something or to get something, what supplies he needed. And that was all interwoven with these anatomy sketches, you know, I mean. That's probably, don't you think, Jason, why a little bit earlier it was discounted. It wasn't, nobody really knew what they had.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. And also, to your point, Mark, this writing was backward too. So, like, you know, not right. To minimize the fact that these were in very small sketchbooks that was also written backward, which is amazing. But yes, I think there was maybe something to that. You know, his work wasn't taken particularly seriously until it was published. And so I think that's the other half of it. It may be because it was filled with notes that were not related. But on the other hand, it's probably related to the fact that he didn't get around to showing it off very much. So you actually made a really interesting point a minute ago, Mark, about sort of refining illustrations. And you're absolutely correct. One of the things that stuck out to me, however, was that you find very rare occasions where the skull of an animal is seen on the inside, but human skulls are illustrated from the inside quite a bit. And there's probably a reason for that. The reason I suspect is that he was interested as a man of the Renaissance finding the soul. And so he was looking for what was known as the senso comune, right? And he didn't expect to find that in an animal, but he expected to find it in a human. And he thought that would be found inside the skull. So you see lots of great illustrations from the inside perspective of a human skull and nothing in animal skulls, almost nothing. Actually, I can't think of a single one.
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Jason Organ and our own Mark Kiesling about the wonderful world of Leonardo da Vinci. And I think we'll go back down that search for the soul road here with you, Jason. We're going to take a short break and come right back, so stay tuned.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Hello, everybody. I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Diamond 88.7 WICR. Our show revolves around the great American songbook, and this week we present the best pipes in the business, part one of Mr. Vic Damone. So join us this Sunday, 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Diamond 88.7 WICR.
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And we're talking with Dr. Jason Organ, Assistant Professor of Anatomy at Indiana University School of Medicine, and me, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit.
And Mark and Jason, we were talking about the search for the soul. And I think, Mark, that reminds me of what you said at the very beginning about what interested you so much in Da Vinci is that fluid ability about him to go back and forth between art and science, that real humanity sense of him.
Yeah, and Jason, you were absolutely right. It was a sign of the time. It was a very unique period. That's the other thing that benefited people like Leonardo. I mean, Michelangelo was in that same period of time. But it was a time where there was an openness, just a little bit of openness in the church, for one. And I think that was when the Medici family was really responsible for a lot of what was happening in the Renaissance. So there was a search for, I would say, Jason, not only soul, but truth. Mm-hmm. In other words, people were trying, the early beginnings of what we now call in science, where we were trying to find out, not necessarily does science find the truth, but what I mean is searching for things, what's out, how does something actually work? So in a way, he was allowed to do things like have bodies of, you know, that were from dead people, and that they kind of turned an eye away from him. And even in his living conditions, and, you know, we are pretty sure that he was gay. And so the church turned their eye away from that. But his quest to really, and Jason got it right on the head, his quest was really to find what is the soul of what makes a human, down to the level of his, a lot of his last work was, I remember distinctly, was trying to figure out what was making facial things work. So how did the eyes, the cheeks, the mouth, he spent an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out how the mouth could make all the shapes that it made. From anatomy. So he got really curious, and that helped inform his painting, but it was way more than that. I mean, he went so deep in, it was down a rabbit hole that it was in there. So I think that was, I mean, I think it was a quest for the soul, but I think it was a quest for the truth, the knowledge of what makes a human human? And that's why he probably ignored the bear feet. You know, I mean, he was probably so, he had them because he wanted to figure out how the relative locomotion, but I think he wasn't really concerned. But on humans, wow, he was completely.
Yeah, so what's interesting, back to the bear, is that, you know, we talked about the detail he noticed in the human, but not in the bear. But some of the detail that he noticed in the bear is exquisite. Like, for example, just like in humans, you know, we talked about long flexor tendons and short flexor tendons of the big toe. That's special. The rest of the toes, and actually all of the fingers too, with the thumb is another exception because it's weird. It's a weird finger, right? But the non-big toe and non-thumb digits have long flexor tendons that actually split the short tendons, short flexor tendons. So they, you know, they actually go right through the middle of them. Just like if they had those little sesamoid bones, they would. We got it right in the bear too. He just missed those sesamoid bones, right? So he got the locomotion part, but some of that detail I think was not of interest to him, which is fine. I understand that. I mean, he was searching for soul. I found soul when I found my mom's Aretha Franklin, so I get it. When you find it, you stop. So.
Yeah, and he's so much, part of what he was criticized, Jill, in his life for was not completing things.
Yeah.
In fact, we have very few, in that exhibition, there were very few, and they collected almost everything that he had finished, very few pieces that he ever completed, much to the chagrin of who was paying him, right? I mean, he's had these commissions, and he would not finish it. And part of that is that he was questing for something more than that. It wasn't the finished work. It was more about the process. And so I think when you were asking me that earlier question, why it inspired me, it's more about the quest in Da Vinci Pursuit, looking for being curious about the world, than it is finding the answer or finishing the project. It's much more about the search. And that's part of the human soul, I think. That makes us human.
I agree. I mean, that certainly resonates with me a lot, right? I can see myself. I can see myself in that picture very well. You know, I love to start new projects and get, you know, attracted by different shiny objects. And I do sometimes have trouble bringing a project to completion. What makes us successful, however, is when we can do that and still also be challenged by the constant, you know, barrage of shiny objects that want our attention. So,
for the both of you, when you were able to go back and look at his research and his pictures and in that exhibition, Mark, could you see the progress? Could you see him getting better at the things that he did, or periods of time where things just kind of stagnated and made you wonder what he was going through in his mind and in his surroundings at that time?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting parts about him. One, and you could get that sense in there, was that he kept a lot, he moved. So he didn't stay in Florence all the time. He moved to other places, other city states within Italy. But he was interesting. He took a lot of those big paintings with him that he hadn't finished, and he was still working on them. And so you see variations in it, and the only way we could see it in the exhibition, which was really cool, was they had gone and they had imaged them with modern day imaging, and they could see different iterations painted on top of another. So he was working his problems out over time and altering his paintings significantly. That's why he never wanted them to give them away, because they weren't done. You know, in his mind, they weren't done, they weren't going to be done, and so he kept working that. And we now know from the imaging that he made huge changes as his skill got different. And we, in many of his early paintings, he's got some really great skill in certain things like robes flowing, hair. He was known for the way he got hair right to be, you know, a kind of wispy. Artists up to that time really didn't get that. But he had other things terribly wrong, you know, perspective. He was really bad at perspective early on. You see an improvement as he got more skill.
And Jason, did you find similar when you were looking back through the research on him and such?
I didn't see as much of that. I think in part because the anatomical illustrations were were not paintings, right? They were drawings. And so I didn't see the originals the way that Mark did. And so because of that, I wasn't able to see where there were places that were touched up or fixed and that sort of stuff. That said, because I didn't see that, I have to imagine it happened. Because the art, you know, the pieces of art, the anatomical illustrations are pretty well complete. You know, and if they're not, you know, as Mark was saying, there's all sorts of patchwork illustrations on a single sheet in these workbooks. And sometimes one of the illustrations will be complete and one will just be a sketch that is very abstract and never went anywhere. And so, you know, I think we saw mostly the finished products of those illustrations.
Yeah, I think we did, particularly on the anatomic ones. So what's interesting, I don't know if you have this sense, Jason, and you do, Jill, but I can almost imagine him after you think about him, you know, imagine him moving and having a cart loaded with all these works wrapped in kind of claws and things falling out everywhere and being kind of just like the absent-minded professor kind of guy, just being kind of odd. He wore, you know, purposely odd robes and colors and things. He was very quirky. And so you just can imagine him moving from village to village being quite the, you know, quite the amusement to many people. But
And actually, you know, at the end of his life, when he moved to France, he took some of his major pieces of work with him on the back of a donkey across the Alps, right?
So yeah, I know.
It's quite impressive. You know, we complain about plane rides sometimes and not enough space to carry stuff. I can't imagine what that was like.
Yeah. I mean, he's carrying these major works that we now have with him on there. And he's carrying all of his workbooks he was taking with him.
Mm-hmm.
He left some things with Jill as along the way. He would leave some things with people that were very special to him that he could entrust to keep things. But those big works, Jason's right. I mean, they were never out of his touch. It didn't matter who he was with. He kept those things wherever he went. And it's really interesting. He was also, he was lucky that he had so many benefactors and they put up with his quirkiness. You know, they would get mad at him, but instead of, because they knew he was such genius, but instead of getting mad at him, like we would, I'm going to cut you off. They had stages of trying to cut him off, but he had so much charisma. And had other people, he also had a little bit of politic. So he would play with somebody that was the Duke of Milan, get him on his side. Well, then the guy in Florence was pretty upset that he was too close to there. So he's kind of letting his commission kind of go. It's just, he's a fascinating individual in that he was really savvy to his time and how to make the world work for him. I can only imagine he was probably pretty self-centered and very caring about what he was working on in himself, but it is interesting.
Yeah, so I actually read that part of the reason that he went down to France was he was so fed up that Michelangelo was getting all the commissions, and maybe it was in part because he wasn't finishing the ones he was getting. That's why he left for France. So, or at least in part, that's why he left for France.
And it was interesting, Mark, how you brought up that some of the things that we thought maybe he was experimenting on the first helicopter or birds and that kind of thing, he was actually building like props for pageants because the, you know, religious ceremonies were so big. And that's where a lot of the money and support and probably safety factor for him to be able to do the things that he did without being cast aside or sent to prison or something.
That's right. And because of the Medici, during that time, the Medici to hold on to power while they were actually siphoning most of the money away, to keep people from being unhappy within their domain, they hosted these big pageants. And so they were having artists like Leonardo build these incredibly amazing animated things that could be on a pole or could be carried by people or they could be in them. And they did that, and it was to entertain the people and help them be happy that they didn't have anything, right? You know, they had these big festivals. And so that was big money for an artist in terms of getting a commission to do them. So you can see why Da Vinci was looking at locomotion besides his paintings. He was looking at anything in nature that would give him some way of creating something that nobody had ever seen. So something that rotated like a helicopter would be unbelievable to somebody looking on. So we know he did engineer some things for the purpose of making something work, like some water screws and things like that. But a lot of things that were misinterpreted as being, oh, he's the precursor to something like he had this interest in a wooden tank. Well, most people thought the tank was really for a pageant, not now. I mean, they think that it was. At one time in the past, they thought, well, he had this obsession with it, but it was, he's just making these fantastical things.
Jason, what was the conversation like at the colloquium then, after you gave your presentation and people heard more about Da Vinci, that maybe things that they didn't know?
It's a great question. We all learned something new. So there were several anatomists here. I focused on sort of musculoskeletal limb anatomy, spine anatomy, that kind of stuff. But we had several others focusing on other aspects. So for example, we had one speaker who was looking at the face or the smile of Mona Lisa. And in particular, this person is an expert in muscles of facial expression. And in particular, the types of fibers that are in those muscles. So we have some muscle fibers that are faster twitching and some that are slower twitching, and muscles that twitch faster or have a predominantly higher proportion of fast twitch fibers fatigue much more quickly than muscles that have slower twitching fibers. And we know a lot about that from locomotor muscles, like in the legs and arms. But we also know quite a bit now about the composition of the muscles of facial expression because of this particular researcher. And she made an interesting argument about the smile of Mona Lisa, in the sense that the muscles that would be required to make that pose were probably the muscles with the highest proportion of the slower twitching fibers. So they wouldn't fatigue quite as much, and therefore model wouldn't, you know, Mona Lisa wouldn't have tired of her position. And so Da Vinci could have painted her, in a much more realistic fashion in that regard. And I thought that was really interesting. So she actually looked at which muscles were required to make that pose, and then what were the fiber types in those muscles in humans, what are they like in other animals, and so on and so forth. It was really interesting.
Yeah, and we had talked earlier about him evolving. By the time was doing that one, he'd also evolved where he understood perspective at a level that a few artists have even since. And so part of why she's so intriguing is he kind of put it so that you are off center. We're used to looking at a painting straight on. So if you look at Mona Lisa straight on, it's not as powerful as if you're just a little off. And if you're a little off center, she appears to look at you and appears to move with you. So he's got this kind of like where she's almost looking at you as you walk, which is a really talented trick in the way he did shadowing from different angles. So he understood that as you moved across a painting, that the shadows being different would cause it to get a sense of 3D that no painters really discovered. He's amazing.
There was also the background of the Mona Lisa, which most people don't pay attention to at all, but yeah. It is filled with intricate details that only scientists might pick up on. Which is, I think, really speaks to Leonardo's ability to observe things in the natural world. So, for example, in the background of that particular painting, there is stratigraphic representations of soil layers that that geologists would pick up immediately, right? Oh, look at that. He's seeing this and that and, you know, the other. But most people just look at it and say, oh, there's just a background. It's nothing particularly exciting. But he picked up these details that are intriguing for lots of different audiences. I think that's pretty amazing. That speaks to his genius, I think, in a way that perhaps other things don't.
Yeah, and you know, a parallel in today's world of genius like that, when we think of Pixar trying to figure out the same thing, the things that are most hard to represent in art and paintings are things that flow. So water, hair, if you think about that, all those things that move, they're the hardest thing to animate too. And so the Pixar engineers were working back and forth, Jason, I believe, with anatomists as well, and looking at images and other things, trying to figure out how to make the hair move in a natural way. or, you know, fins on a fish, or the water to move. And so that was pretty much what he was doing. You know, 500 years ago, he's playing with flow. And in many of his backgrounds and other things, he spent an enormous amount of hours, you can tell, just on the water flow when that wasn't even the primary subject. He was just trying to get the flow of water right.
But it almost makes you wonder if maybe that was his primary subject and he was just fooling the rest of us by, like with the Mona Lisa, putting a person in the front when he was really much more interested in what was going on in the background.
That's real possible, because a lot of times he was commissioned to paint someone's daughter, for instance. And he knew he had to do that, but he was much more interested in what he was interested in. And so there are some thought that he spent huge amounts of times on unfinished paintings where they were incredibly detailed. He had a commission to finish them. He never did. But he was working on some details that probably nobody else would care about. And they were things like the rocks in the background, or the robe. I'm sorry, he didn't finish the face, but he was finishing the robe that was flowing. So he was noted for that. And early on in his early career, the early masters used him that he was mentored by. They used him in that way to paint certain parts that nobody else could paint like that. You know, nobody could get those details.
The presentation that you saw, Mark, how was it presented to the public? What was it, a timeline kind of thing, or works type of thing?
No, it was not a timeline. And that was the exciting thing. You know, typically we see in a lot of art museums, we see a flow from here's the early work to the other. It was more of capturing around the type of things he had. So it was like an anatomy section, an engineering part, commissioned work. There was a whole section that was just on how they unpacked what we know about him. So there was a whole section on imaging and how today we use technologies to go back to an artist and see what they were intending or what did they use. I think the interesting thing about him was he was so not interested in the final product that he was experimenting as a scientist would with chemistry in the medium. And so he notoriously did things that destroyed themselves. And so he would use certain inks with certain paints with certain kinds of vehicles, and they were already in his lifetime deteriorating, much to the chagrin of the person that commissioned the work. So many of his works, and so we see many things like The Last Supper and others that were painted by what I would say were conservators along the way, trying to preserve his artwork and getting it wrong. So that's what's great about this imaging area, is you can see where somebody else has painted, but then you can see what his original looked like. And often they look totally different. I mean, and so he didn't really care about whether the painting lasted. That's the thing. He was sort of all enamored with, can I get this color right? Or can I get this to do something that, can I get this paint to flow in a way that others don't? So
perhaps his genius manifested in another way, and he was really concerned about job stability.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's clever, and I my hat tip to him for that.
Well, we are talking about all things Da Vinci today, and we want to remind you that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who does support the Da Vinci Pursuits mission of creating a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and the community can all come together for unique activities and conversations. And we're going to continue ours in just a minute. We'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
To an era that started a rebellion.
With a rebel, yeah. She cried, mom, mom, mom.
Or even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shaped rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR. We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're chatting with Jason Organ. An anatomist who has had some wonderful experiences preparing for a colloquium and attending a colloquium in France with other anatomists. Welcome back, Jason. Great conversations about Da Vinci and the spirit of that. And one of the things that I think is really important is how much our technology today, Jill, has allowed us to have some things be accessible. For one, just you can actually go through online and look at almost every page of his notebooks.
Wow.
I mean, that is available. You can buy them as, you know, as things printed, but it's pretty amazing. Yes, it's hard to read because it's Latin backwards, but it is, it's amazing. I wanted to say one thing on that, by the way. He wrote that way, it's believed now. He wrote backwards, not because he was trying to make it secret, because you could do it, put it in a mirror and read it. It was because he's left-handed. And the ink would smear if he wrote it in the other way. So by writing his characters backwards, going from the bottom up, he was never getting his hand in the paint. And that is also a key to how today people are able to sometimes identify his artwork, because his hand is hatching, which is a cross hatch that he uses in many of his drawings, are backwards of other people's because he was lefty. And so most artists were right. And that's how they were able to say, oh, that may have been Leonardo that did that in a painting because it was done by a lefty. So I think that's interesting.
It is. It's like a CSI kind of thing. If you're trying to determine whether it's the real thing or not.
Right. And it's hard. It is really hard. Michelangelo, all those guys, it's really hard to identify certain things as who is the real artist. Mm-hmm. Because they worked collaboratively early on in their studio days. Later, when they get really famous, yes, there's things we can attribute, like Mona Lisa, there's no question. But early works, it's interesting to see for all of them, and that's interesting for people that get, once we get past a little bit of this and they reopen the Indianapolis Museum of Art at Newfields. I encourage people to look in on that exhibit that they have on what they do in the conservation lab, because it's through those things that we're finding out, it's through the present day science that we're finding out much about our artists and artwork.
Yeah, because back then, as you mentioned, I mean, the jobs were few, but the artists were many, and everybody wanted the same style. So everybody kind of painted the same way. And then, as you know, we move through time, we have these different explosions and changes in the art world when artists finally broke out and did their own thing. And in this day and age, everybody wants to be so individual. Sometimes it's hard to think back that's the way things were at one time.
Yeah.
Jason, do you use any of, as Mark was mentioning, the electronic pictures and of Da Vinci's work with your students and the things that you discovered? Have you shared them with your students?
So not so much with my students, but with my family for sure. I have on occasion used his anatomical illustrations in my lectures because it makes a good point, especially with regard to the structure of the foot, because I think we've discussed this a number of times now, and I just geek out over that. I think it's a really interesting and evolutionary solution to a problem. And he actually made the same argument. I mean, made the argument about how those sesamoid bones work. And so now I show my students every year, his actual notes on how this works. And I said, if it was good enough for Leonardo, it's good enough for you. So, I think that there's a benefit of using those things. But I've also directed my students, if they're interested, to take a look at the Royal Collection Trust has an app of all of Da Vinci's anatomical illustrations. They're phenomenal. And they're all digitized. And you can flip through them and compare them against Primal Anatomy Images, which is a brand of medical illustration images for anatomical sciences, and compare against them. What did Leonardo see, and what do modern anatomists see when they dissect? And it's phenomenal. And I wish I had known about that before I started delving into it, because it would have made my job easier to locate some of these illustrations. But I'm glad I found it now. So,
the more you learned about Da Vinci, Jason, and the artistic and the human and kind of quirky side of him, do you take that information back with you to your students to kind of reemphasize with them that there is a human side to everything, especially when it comes to teaching medicine, no matter what form it is?
Absolutely. So that's been one of the things that I've been working on for the last several years, is bringing humanities back into our anatomy curriculum, in part because we have a tendency to want to refer to our donors as cadavers. And that doesn't sit well with me. Yes, they are cadavers. It's true. But they were people. They should be treated with the respect of being a person, not being a sample, right? And so I don't like to refer to cadaveric material in the classroom. I like to refer to our donors. And yes, we don't name our donors in the classroom because they've given their bodies, but they haven't given you their histories. They haven't given you permission to know about them as people. They have given you permission to know about them as mammals, right? But they're still people. And so I want to make sure that our students understand that. So this year, actually, and we've discussed this on the program, I have introduced a bunch of humanities-related assignments and programs, one of which was to bring some of the history of racism and anti-Semitism in the field of anatomy into the classroom, so that people understand that things are not the way they used to be, right? One of the questions that we get all the time is, where do our donors come from? And it's a great question, and it's an important question. And the truth is, here in Indiana, I think almost every single one, with the exception of maybe one or two over the last 10 years, have been donated bodies. People give of themselves willfully. So they will their body to the medical sciences program at Indiana University. And we are grateful that they do that. They want to help the next generation of doctors learn. And that is a gift that we could never repay. Occasionally, we will get an unclaimed body, but I don't think we've ever used them for educational purposes. We are just the place where that ends up, in the rare occasion that we have one of those. And I think it's, again, only happened once or twice in 10 years, if at all. So this year we brought Dr. Sabina Hildebrandt to campus. We brought her on the program as well, to talk about the atrocities during World War II with anatomists under the control of the Nazi Party, and in particular those that were affiliated with it. And so we spent a lot of time talking about sort of where donors came from then, or I should say where cadavers came from then, and where our donors come from now, and how it's fundamentally different. We're not dissecting the bodies of executed prisoners. We are not dissecting the bodies of victims of genocide. We are dissecting bodies of people who wanted to help you learn and weren't forced to make you learn. And so, again, this whole humanities aspect relates back to Leonardo. He was one of the first people here to really get access to humans. Prior to that, there wasn't much access. And again, it's to Mark's point, because the church relaxed a little bit and allowed him to do that. He was one of the few that was able to do that for a long time. And then, of course, we ended up with executions being the primary mode of procurement of cadaveric material all the way up until the 1800s with the Burke and Hare murders in Scotland. And so, you know, it's an ugly history, and my students need to understand that things are not the same way they were, and bringing that information, even if it's just a little bit of information, into the classroom gives them a greater sense of the importance of treating their donor with the respect that's necessary.
Well, Jason, you do a great job with them. You do a wonderful job with our listening audience, and we want to thank you again for spending this hour with all of us and sharing what you've learned. And Mark, the same with you. We are all big fans of Da Vinci Pursuit, and this has just been a real treat today to get to hear a little bit more about it with you. So thank you, Jason, so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure. Anytime. I will come on anytime.
We like that. And you'll find pictures of our projects and obviously us as guests on our website, davincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
Until next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.